New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in many of the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we'll be exploring the Mandela Effect. My guest is my old friend Cynthia Sue Larson, who is author of many books, including Quantum Jumps and Reality Shifts When Consciousness Changes the Physical World. She is the founder of the International Mandela Effect Conference. Her most recent book is The Mandela Effect and Its Society, Awakening from Me to We. I've done a previous interview with Cynthia Sue Larson about how malleable is reality, and I would encourage viewers to watch that video. It'll help prepare you for this one. If you haven't already watched it, it's a couple of years old, and the link to it will be in the upper right-hand corner of your screen for those of you who have equipment that can accept such a link. Cynthia Sue lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Cynthia Sue. It's a pleasure to be with you. We've known each other for so many years, and I've been watching your work evolve over these years. I have to say, I think your newest book on the Mandela Effect is the most well-researched book on the topic that of which I'm aware. I know you have delved much more deeply into the field. In fact, it is a field. I think when we first began talking about the Mandela Effect, it was sort of a curiosity. It wasn't a field. But now I noticed the title of your new book, The Mandela Effect and Its Society. And that, I presume, means the organization of people who are now taking this ostensible phenomenon seriously.
Yes, absolutely. That's true. And thank you so much for your interest in the topic and for interviewing me previously. Because at that time, you were able to inform me about Mary Rose Barrington, who at the time I didn't remember or know about, actually. But yes, this topic is finally getting some serious attention. I've just yesterday received an email from a PhD candidate in psychology who is researching aspects related to the Mandela Effect. And obviously that kind of work can't be done unless and until the topic is taken at least somewhat seriously. And you, more than anyone I know, are familiar with some of the hurdles involved when people start moving into a field of research which has not been considered to be substantial, meaningful, or legitimate. And to me, it's quite legitimate. And thank you for talking with me about it today.
Well, you mentioned Mary Rose Barrington and her book, Jot, J-O-T-T, just one of those things. It's an early investigation, I guess it'd be fair to say, into these phenomena. And that's an interesting phrase, just one of those things. It's like it happens, apparently. The sorts of things we'll be talking about are extremely common. Almost everybody has had such an experience and dismissed it as just some quirky thing. It must be, most people would assume, an error on their part. After all, we're all human. We all make errors.
Exactly. She would talk about flyaways and comebacks and things like that in such colloquial language, like things, they fly away and they come back, which I think is cute. So in the terminology and the lexicon that I've been using when talking with firsthand reporters of this phenomenon, they usually talk about things disappearing or reappearing, or coming, arriving out of nowhere, like in a In fact, sometimes in front of people. So these can be quite remarkable. And I know that in parapsychology, these things have been reported as well. So but it's interesting to notice that there can be this awareness that it is just one of those things.
Parapsychologists have their defined categories. We talk about extrasensory perception, psychokinesis. A few brave parapsychologists look at the question of survival after death. But when it comes to the Mandela effect, there's a tiny number of parapsychologists who are willing to take it seriously. Most of them, anything, frankly, associated with large-scale phenomenon, macro-PK, is extremely controversial, even in the parapsychology community.
Yes, thank you for pointing that out. That's really true. And some of the recent research that's been done on the Mandela effect seems to me to be coming from an assumptive place that this must be mistaken memory, obviously. So it's almost like the psychologists are looking for what was the trigger that makes groups of people what they call misremember things the same way. They're looking for signs of confabulation, which is actually sort of a mental problem. Like if people were confabulating, then they would have a mental issue. And we don't usually have memory problems when we're talking with, talking about something like your mother doesn't recognize you. Your first assumption would not be that you were confused, that that's not your mother. Like if your mother says, you're not my child, you would assume, obviously, she must be having a mental issue, like Alzheimer's or something. And so when we remember things, we know that we're not misremembering them in some cases. Now, there are cases, of course, where we can misremember things. And I think that muddies the water in some people's minds. The stuff I'm talking about is just aggravating enough that a lot of scientists, and I've got a background in physics, so I talk to physicists, and I know that they don't want to get into these muddy waters where there could be some element of possible confusion, which is typical of pretty much every area of consciousness research, as you know.
We have to assume that a half of our audience will be familiar with the Mandela effect, and the other half will not have heard about it. So for the benefit of that half of the audience, let's define it.
Right. The Mandela effect is, I think we can all agree that it has to do with groups of people remembering something differently than what the official description of historical facts might be. And in fact, it might even be very different than all the evidence that you can find. Yet, people persist, for example, in saying that they remember for sure Nelson Mandela dying in prison when he was incarcerated in South Africa on Robben's Island back in, a lot of people remember it was 1987. But the official history, the official facts clearly show that, in fact, Nelson Mandela survived his prison ordeal, and he went on to become the president of South Africa, which we can all agree on also. So really, and this is a rather remarkable thing that the Mandela effect is named after what I would call an alive again experience, because I don't think these are the most common types of Mandela effects or reality shifts. They're rather unusual. Most people, you might notice on the periphery, like, didn't the friend of the family pass away and now they're alive again? That could happen. And I get a lot of reports about such things. But more typically, it would be along the lines of Mary Rose Barrington's research about just one of those things where a product suddenly is different than what people remember it always was. Like Kit Kat, people remember there was a hyphen between Kit and Kat, and Berenstain or Berenstain Bears. People remember the Berenstain Bears, but now it's always been Berenstain. Location of physical organs, and so on and so forth. Geography, pretty much everything.
We need to be a little more specific when you say location of physical organs. What do you mean?
Okay, well, what I mean is, for example, the kidneys. People remember that they used to be situated low enough in the physical body that if you were struck from behind with a roundhouse kick, if you're doing mixed martial arts, or a punch to the lower back, that this would conceivably seriously damage the kidneys. But and in fact, I did find residue evidence from an old book that showed that it was called a kidney punch back in the day when the kidneys used to be down below, underneath, lower than the rib cage. And if a doctor needed to operate on them, they would go from behind. That's no longer the case, and now it supposedly never has been the case. And this is quite vexing to people who remember that they would have kidney procedures done because they've got kidney issues. They remember the doctors used to do the procedure differently. And it's quite strange to have such a personal recollection of things being so different.
I think one of the most convincing cases that you write about involves the great Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung.
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes. Yes, this was this is an interesting story, so I want to take my time a little bit with it. And it hasn't been well reported yet, so I'm really happy I got to cover it in my new book, The Mandela Effect and Its Society. So it starts in 1932, I believe, when Dr. Carl Jung was visiting Ravenna, Italy. He was there to be a sightseer and tourist, but he especially wanted to visit the baptistry of the Orthodox. There we go. It's not a place I've been to yet myself. But when he was there with a friend, Tony Wolf, he remembered something quite remarkable and stunning. It's actually several details that he was apparently talking about with Tony Wolf while he was there. First of all, there was a very special blue light inside the building. Secondly, there were, in this octagonal space, there were four prominent 6 by 8 foot, mosaics, which are made of tile, and they were huge, and each one dedicated to a certain image of a baptism. One of them was Saint Peter and being saved by God. Another one was the Israelites in their rush through the Red Sea, and they arrived safely, but that water was involved there. One was the baptism of Jesus Christ himself, and then one was the leprosy guy. I can't remember his name. The Syrian, Naaman the Syrian, I think. Yeah, I'm not so good on all these details. But the interesting thing is, the fascinating thing, the thing that really grabbed Carl Jung and did not let him go, is that when he told people about this, when he wanted to go back and return to see these again, they never did exist. They weren't there, never were there, even though he and Tony Wolf both had seen them together, had talked about them together, had really commented on how extraordinary they were back in 1932. So decades later, Carl Jung is still perplexed by this extraordinary mystery. And when he'd sent people to please check it out, you know, see if you can take pictures or bring me postcards, they don't exist because these mosaics supposedly have never existed.
So Jung, if I recall from your book, seemed to feel that what must have occurred is that he had these images of the mosaics in his mind, and he projected from his own mind so that they appeared to him and Tony Wolf, who was with him, to be external to them.
Yes, it was. It's kind of an extraordinary thing. Now, here's the father of synchronicity. We would think, at least that's when I think synchronicity, I think Carl Jung. And he's noticing that there's this interesting, just like with synchronicity, there's an internal component to this very external realization. And because of Carl Jung already looking at such things, I believe, he was already aware of the collective unconscious. He's aware of archetypal energies and the ideas that archetypal beings can have. And so I think this made it possible for him to recognize what you're saying exactly, that he knew there was this internal component to a supposedly external experience. Absolutely.
And another example that you give in your book that I found very persuasive involved a museum. I think it was in a relatively small town, but the museum had a dinosaur exhibit that many people remembered the dinosaur exhibit and were surprised when to discover it was gone. Not only was it gone, but according to museum officials, had never been there.
Exactly. Yeah, this is from a small town in England. It's called Bolton. And the city council members were quite concerned because some of them started wondering, they now had their own children and they wanted to know, why is this dinosaur that I grew up seeing in our city museum, why is it not there? And whatever you're doing with it, maybe it went down for reconstruction or repair, cleaning, whatever you guys are doing, bring it back. Enough's enough. It's been decades. I don't know when I last saw it. And about half the council remembered that there had been a dinosaur prominently displayed, not just some sort of like a back closet thing, but it had been one of the primary features that people remembered. And that about half of the town council remembered it. The other half said, what are you guys talking about? We've never had a dinosaur. We don't remember it. There's no evidence of it. We are looking for it. What does this dinosaur supposedly look like? And the council members and the other town members that remembered it, they all agreed exactly what it looked like and how it appeared and where it was placed and what kind of dinosaur it was. So it was such a strong outcry from about half of the populace of the town of Bolton that they went ahead and went to the trouble to purchase and obtain and place the dinosaur that half of them remembered having always had, but it had gone away mysteriously, as such things sometimes do.
You quoted one of those council members who was rather indignant that anybody would think that when he remembers as a child visiting this museum and seeing the dinosaur, that he was making it up or misremembering. He said, that's simply not possible.
Yes, I can read that passage. I remember, this is, I should say who it is. This is Anne Wright, head of the Rumworth School in Bolton, England. So this is very prominently positioned person of great admiration and respect in the community. And she remembers having seen the dinosaur when visiting the museum. She says, I remember a huge dinosaur standing in the entrance to the natural history section. One day I went in and it was no longer there. Later on, when I asked about it, none of the staff could remember anything about it, but I know I saw it. Now, nobody seems to know anything about it. It's bizarre. And this defines the whole Mandela effect experience. When people are collectively so convinced that something absolutely is the way they remember it, yet the historical facts don't support that. Aside from the fact that so many people remember something that supposedly never existed. So that's what's amazing about this Mandela effect, is that we can start to acknowledge and honor that something is going on when we do have a collective mismatched memory. And that would be the term I would use to define the phenomenon. It's more of a mismatch between what an individual and a group of people might remember versus what is supposedly historically true and has always, quote unquote, always been true.
Now, in our previous interview, I show photographs of this massive sundial out at the Berkeley Marina, Berkeley, California. You were there with friends in a courtyard where the sundial normally is, and you and your friends all remarked, there's no sundial here.
Yes, I was there with my friends Cliff and Jan, and we were frequently going to have brunch at the same restaurant on a, I think, monthly basis at the time. So we were familiar with going for a brunch and then walking around afterward. And this time that we walked around, for some reason, I think I brought up the, I didn't call it the Mandela effect. I was talking about a very similar, identical phenomenon, really, reality shifts. So when I was discussing it, I asked, have either of you noticed anything like that? And then suddenly, it's almost like it prompted this, what happened next, because we looked up and suddenly there was this very weathered, large concrete sundial sculpture that looked like it had been there for decades, and it was blocking the sort of a plaza that we used to walk through. It was also directly blocking the another sculpture that was there, an archer sculpture. So it was quite prominent, quite unmistakable, yet it was new to all of us, and that seemed like a perfect way to just discuss this phenomenon. Like, wow, we are witnessing one right now. This is exactly what I'm talking about. Reality shifts where things appear, disappear, transform, transport. And with the Mandela effect, it's the same thing. You know, we'll see things that are completely different than we may remember. And I did do follow-up with the harbor master to find out, when did that sundial sculpture arrive? And I was informed that it had been there as a gift from a sister city in Japan to the city of Berkeley, California, for decades. So that was stunning, to say the least.
Your life has been colored by events of this sort, and I suppose enhanced by the fact that you now look for them.
Yes, that's true. I think it's partly due to the fact that I was interested in finding out what else could I observe changing like this. Having such a clear intention and being focused on that. And I must add, I've always kept this special secret sauce of the question, how good can it get? That's important because I don't want to be experiencing horrific, nightmarish reality shifts. So it's important to keep locked in on a very positive upward trajectory. But yes, I'm certain because of that intention, I've therefore been witness to things that I think would blow people's minds. But I was already expecting, like, okay, I know consciousness on the inside can influence what we appear, what we think of as the physical world. We think it's separate. We tend to assume in the sciences currently, Western science, that what we measure, that's the starting point. What's material? What's real? We seldom give prominence and priority to the idea that consciousness is fundamental. But with this starting assumption that consciousness is fundamental, now let's see, where can we go? How good can it get as we're experiencing these shifts? I've definitely seen a lot more than I think most people ever see.
And in addition to keeping track of events like this in your own life, you collect stories from other people and at this point have thousands of examples.
Yes, and this does count as a body of firsthand reports and research. These are basically case studies, and so it's not just anecdotal evidence. I first heard the difference between this recommended and pointed out by Dr. Larry Dossey, and I was so impressed that he made that very clear delineation, you know, that if you've got, when people and skeptics say that's just anecdotal evidence, you know, that's just you misremembering things, you can then strengthen the case by going to firsthand reports from people who know for sure that they did witness a change. That, for example, they always celebrated their birthday and it was far away. It was maybe either close to or far away from American Thanksgiving. And now it's different. They know that American Thanksgiving used to be on the third Thursday of November. I remember that. And I've heard from people who say they know for sure because their birthday was on or around, you know, one or the other, where it ended up or where Thanksgiving used to be. So these firsthand reports matter. They're extremely important, and we're at our own risk to disregard and throw out the baby with the bathwater here, because it's extremely important to respect, honor, and investigate the kinds of reports that I've been receiving. And I think other people are increasingly starting to track this as well. Fiona Broom now has a website that does that, and some others are doing that too.
In addition, you describe, I think, 7 or 8 potential theoretical explanations that would be consistent with modern physics.
Yes, I do delve into possible theories of what's going on. Some of them have a lot to do with modern physics, and those are my favorites because maybe it's bias. I admit I do have a degree in physics from UC Berkeley. So some people would say, well, you're biased. You're not going to come out against the CERN Large Hadron Collider. And, because some people consider that to be part of what's happening, is that something happened at the Large Hadron Collider and they've ripped a hole through space-time. My approach in the book, The Mandela Effect and Its Society, is more to go into the idea that that quantum physics is natural. It's part of our natural world. It's part of who we are. And it shows us how we, in the form of consciousness, influence material reality. So that's, I think, the most fascinating direction to study what's behind the phenomenon, is to look there. And so that's why I focus so prominently on that and include huge chapter that includes terminology from quantum physics, because I'd like to make it more naturally known to people, to become comfortable with the quantum nature that we all have intrinsically.
Well, one of the most important theories within quantum physics is known as the observer effect, or the idea that consciousness itself collapses the wave function, that the equations of quantum physics don't call for any specific objects ever to be observed. In quantum physics, everything is a probability field, but when we do experiments, we get particular observations. And there's a school of physics that says that that particular observation requires an observer. It's the consciousness of the observer that enables this condensation from a probability wave to something measurable.
Exactly. Yes, this is the if you want to look at the, you know, what's the name of the interpretation of quantum physics that takes us there, this is the Copenhagen interpretation is the first version that really talked about the collapse of that wave function. And then people such as Dr. Quantum, our mutual friend Fred Allen Wolf, you know, he's definitely helped to increase awareness from people looking at this in What the Bleep Do We Know and in his many wonderful books. So when we look at this collapse of the wave function, we see ideas like this experiment of the Schrödinger cat experiment, which is the idea that a cat is placed inside of a box with a vial of poison with a trigger mechanism that's quantum in nature, based on very random radioactive decay of some quantum particle. So we don't know exactly when the quantum particle will trigger a little hammer to break the glass vial to release the poison inside the closed box containing the cat. Therefore, it's that famous experiment, is the cat alive or is the cat dead? And in regular classical physics, we'd think it's one or the other. But in this wild, woolly, wacky, wonderful world of quantum physics, we don't know for sure, and the cat, until we open the box, until we pop the wave function, the quiff, as Fred Allen Wolf calls it, until we do that, then there's a superposition of states, which is what physicist Erwin Schrödinger was first alarmed about, and basically saying, this is ridiculous. What you're saying is that a cat could be placed in a quantum superposition of states. What's happened in all of these years since Erwin Schrödinger pointed this out and devised this brilliant thought experiment is that we're starting to see lots of experimental evidence suggesting that, as crazy as this sounds, we are indeed witnessing large-scale systems and beings such as ourselves, like you and me and everyone and everything, actually does exist in a superposition of states. And then how do we experience that? Well, this is where it gets interesting, because we would then expect to occasionally witness the Mandela effect and a lot of these paranormal experiences that so many of us have been talking and writing about and experiencing.
I think we should make it clear, Cynthia, that to my knowledge, nobody has ever actually attempted to do this experiment and poison a cat. I know some animal lovers who are friends of mine are horrified when we bring up the story of Schrödinger's cat, because they imagine that, you know, real cats are being treated this way. And to my knowledge, it's just a thought experiment.
Exactly. It's only a thought experiment. No cats have been injured so far. Hopefully never will be injured in this experiment. So it's one of those Gedanken experiments, like Albert Einstein would imagine traveling as a photon of light. It's one of those things where you imagine it from your armchair without injuring any cats. Absolutely.
And another related theory, which is gaining a certain amount of respect within academia, is the idea of the simulated universe, that the world that we experience is actually being generated from some other level of reality, very much the way computer software generates the experience of being inside a multiplayer computer game like World of Warcraft.
Exactly. This is a brilliant current theory, and a lot of top people, including, I think, Elon Musk, and the author Rizwan Virk has written an excellent book on the topic.
Two books, in fact.
Yes, he's a game designer, and so he's had experience as a programmer. I've had lots of experience as a programmer, and I love his books. So if you want what I consider the best books on the topic to be, I'd go to Rizwan Virk. Yeah. Yeah, the simulated multiverse is great. And so the idea here It's riffing off the old idea. I want to give credit to the ancient yogis that were suggesting that everything is a dream and that what we're witnessing, it's the waking life also is a dream. That, I think, is old language for this is a simulation. So now we've got a new word, and now we're looking at who are the programmers, and we're thinking along the lines of our current metaphor with our current technology, which is great. There's nothing wrong with that. But I just want to credit the idea of everything being a dream, because that goes back to some very ancient teachings of the yoga traditions, and it's definitely worth honoring and respecting that. And Rizwan Virk also has a book on autobiography of a yogi. So he's a great, it's good to acknowledge both and to really dive deeply into the topic that way. And from that perspective, we can start to see, I like to give credit to an idea about levels of conscious agency, which I believe was first documented by the philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, when he talks both about the perennial philosophy, which is amazing because then it means all the paths of truth come together, but at such a level that it's hard to document or share agreement that we're all experiencing the same thing. And Leibniz is also one of the fathers of calculus. And so I think it's because of that that he understood a first level perception is an order of perception. And of course, in calculus, you've got orders. And Leibniz was looking at consciousness that way, at looking at levels of conscious awareness. And that's something that I would love to see explored and explained and written about better. I think it's a key concept that people touch on it. Carl Jung touched on it. Rudolf Steiner touched on it. A lot of greats have touched on it, and I'd love to see it really come together in a way people understand. And we're going to be needing it going into robotics, artificial intelligence, and all of that.
I'm very fond of Leibniz's book, Monadology, in which it's, to me, it's the only really rigorous philosophical exploration of the idea of the human soul.
Thank you. And I'm so glad you're honoring him that way, because I really don't hear enough about this. And with the direction, like I just said, we've got AI, we've got robots that we're going to be needing for the technology side of things to understand this. And I don't think we've really spent enough time there. So thank you for the shout out for Leibniz. Yeah, I agree with you. That's brilliant. And that's why I mention him so frequently, because I feel like that's where we can really recognize that, for example, if we're looking at the Internet of Things, which is where AI and robotics is going next, the awareness of a system, like a robotic or AI system, starts with, does it have fingers? It starts with, are those my fingers? Oh, that's me. It's self-awareness through levels of conscious agency, like the monads and the monadology. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you've done some original research in the area of the Mandela effect, looking at personality types. And I found your results fascinating, that using the Myers-Briggs scale, some personality types experience way more of these unusual, bizarre events than other people, other personality types.
Yes, that's true. And these would be the intuitive feelers for those who are familiar with the Myers-Briggs. So there are four different, options. It can be an extrovert or an introvert. And that doesn't seem to matter too much about when it comes to the Mandela effect. But the next one does matter, apparently. And the intuitives are the ones that are definitely experiencing a lot more of these Mandela effects. And the feelers. So intuitive feelers, other psychologists are now researching what are these, how would you describe these people? And they're using words like empath, empathy. They're saying we can develop our empathy. So this quality of intuitive feeling as being a style of engaging with reality, with the outer reality, is very much important. And again, it makes sense with the monadology that we just talked about. The intuitive feelers, what are they doing that's, the feeling is it would be as opposed to thinking. And it doesn't mean they don't think. And it doesn't mean if you're an intuitive feeler, you're not thinking at all. It just means that that would be the preferred engagement modality with so-called external reality, which is really fascinating. So, and I'm intrigued by the fact, like when you look at meaningful coincidences, And Dr. Bernard Beitman has a great book on that topic. He's done some amazingly good research on who are the experiencers of synchronicity, who's more likely to engage with such a phenomenon. And that, again, would be these empaths. Again, it would be what we see in Myers-Briggs as the intuitive feelers. And so study after study is showing this, and it's huge. You're right. It's a minority of people in the general population, maybe only 20%, but they're experiencing some 74, almost 75% of the Mandela effects that are happening. So that's quite noteworthy. And it would give a nod again, I think, to the monadology concept that it is when we start becoming aware that there's something greater than us, that this phenomenon really revs up big time.
In other words, you would reject the interpretation that intuitive feelers are somehow more prone to cognitive error.
Exactly. Thank you. And there's been some work in that field as well. Tony Jinks did some research to show that a wide swath of different cognitive errors are not more prevalent amongst those experiencing what he calls disappearing object phenomenon. But it's very similar to Mary Rose Barrington's just one of those things, and what I've been calling reality shifts. And what we're now saying is pretty much the same as the Mandela effect. And so when he found these cognitive errors are not happening in a tremendously elevated level with people who are noticing shifts in reality, I find that quite reassuring. But I would say that's true. And I've been seeing that with the people reporting these reality shifts to me over decades. These are not crazy people. They're doctors, lawyers, people working in the Pentagon in one case, in elevated levels of society all around the world. So they're not crazy. They're not dysfunctional. They're not losing their minds. They're not making cognitive errors.
You would be of the school of thought that reality is malleable. It's not as stable as we normally, based on kind of a Newtonian mindset, tend to assume.
That's true. Yeah, I find it to be extremely malleable. And people might say, well, then prove it. Do something on demand. And they may not be that rude. I was sitting next to Henry Stapp, and we were watching a physicist honoring Henry Stapp, actually. And the physicist, I'm not going to name names, but he was flipping a coin to indicate this is random. But in that moment, I just got this knowingness that I knew what it was going to be. I forget if it was heads or tails, but I knew for sure. So I just turned to Henry Stapp, the physicist next to me, and said what I thought it was, like, well, this isn't very good, you know, example of randomness, because I already know, I can tell what it is. And then Henry's like, And then the coin flip it completes, and it's exactly what I said it was. And then Henry turned to me and said, can you do that again? And I said, no, because it's not like that. It's something that happens when I need it. Just last month, I was in Colorado with Paula Harris. She's a researcher that interviews people who've experienced UFOs and that sort of thing. She's an Italian-American journalist. We were sharing an apartment, and on the last day, we were locked out. The key code didn't work on the front door, but my suitcase was inside the apartment. And we were in Crestone, Colorado, which is, it's kind of like the Himalayas of Colorado. It's in the middle of nowhere. And it was Memorial Day. So everything was closed. But I said, Paula, this is good news. This is very good news. Because this is something, it's basically a reality shift. We need it. I know you locked the back door. She's like, I locked the back door. I said, yeah, that's not a problem. Because we need it to be open, and this is something I'm pretty good at. So just hang on. I'm going to run around back. I'm pretty sure we'll be in. No worries. Don't need to call the locksmith and wait for 5 hours. Anyway, long story short, that was exactly true. And the whole modality, what am I doing? I'm just lining up who I am and what we need. It's not a parlor trick. It's not for stage performance of proving anything. I just needed to get my suitcase out of that apartment. So as you could call it praying, because that's what it was, just connecting with the divine as I'm running around to the back door. I see the back door, sliding glass door, is in the lock position. I see that. But I'm just in my heart, in my entirety of being, knowing that I'm just going to open that door. And that is what I'm able to do, which seems impossible. It was in a locked position. Paula's very good at locking that door, but this is the sort of thing I'm familiar with. So it does happen, and there's an advantage in knowing that reality is like this, But I would say it's not something to be played with, like a game, like showing off, or nothing prideful or artificial, or no stage performances. But this is real magic, I'd say. But not in the bad sense of where people will say magic for your ego. I would say it's more aligned with what we all need. And I believe, and I see evidence that the Mandela Effect is showing all of humanity a way out of things that we might think are locked doors, like global warming, wars, all of the things we're so afraid of that we think we're stuck in. We see the evidence. We know we're doomed. But I know that we don't need to feel that way. I know that the Mandela Effect is showing us that collectively we can basically connect with that higher sense of goodness. And, you know, miracles really do happen, if you want to call it a miracle. Quantum jumps, reality shifts, Mandela Effects. These things definitely happen, and they are often quite good.
Well, you used the word collectively just now, and I think that's very important to you because of the subtitle of your book on the Mandela Effect, Moving from Me to We. Let's talk about that.
This idea is the Mandela Effect, of course. You could shorten that down to ME. In the community, in the society, often that's what people call it. Like a UFO is an unidentified flying object, and ME is a Mandela Effect. And then what's the we? That would be, you could call it awakening effect or wisdom effect. It's the awareness, as we're talking about right now, that there can be something meaningful about these extraordinary events where history is no longer the way that we remember it. And I know for people listening, if they've never yet really felt like a Mandela Effect is real for them, just having an open mind is often enough to experience it. And they might wonder, why would I want to experience such a thing? And then I'd say, because it can be the pathway forward for all of humanity. What if we are able to collectively change physical reality in a good way, without politics, without billions of dollars being spent on fiscal programs, without indebtedness, basically miraculous changes happening. And I know that that's possible. So it's a very optimistic book that way, and you could say it's even radically optimistic, and I'd say that's a fair thing. But that's exactly what we need right now in this interesting time that we're living in.
So you're suggesting that although these kinds of reality shifts could be disastrous, that we have some control, some measure of control over them.
We do. We've got more than we think we do, and on a home front level, you know, we might think, people, of course, might immediately feel like, well, I'm not Superman, I can't change the world, and we don't need to do it that way. It's more about becoming a good human being, which is, again, that perennial philosophy, that as we move toward a collective sense of oneness, if you want to call it that, or the absolute, all these words for great mystery, that we hopefully are becoming better individuals, becoming better in terms of honesty, integrity, love, kindness, compassion, all these good qualities that we can universally, globally recognize. And when we do that, I do believe that we've got the collective ability to transform world situations instantaneously, as if they've always been in a better level of being. And I know that's not something people are yet familiar with, but this is the dawn of that consciousness, and I'm really glad to be at the forefront of it, even though, as you know, sometimes when you're in the forefront of things, there's a lot of ridicule made about them. I know.
We haven't talked about the multiple worlds theory yet. That's also a very significant theory within mainstream physics. I've been told that most physicists these days subscribe to the many worlds theory, which suggests that for every quantum possibility, there is a universe in which that possibility is actualized. So that there are something like 500 billion billion or a billion to the 500th power of alternative universes all interpenetrating our three-dimensional reality.
That's right. And this was first popularized by Hugh Everett III, who came up with this idea of the many worlds interpretation. And if you're wondering, what's this word interpretation? That's when physicists are seriously attempting to you know, explain what's going on with quantum physics and bring it together with our understanding of, you know, the collective cosmos and all of that. So this many worlds interpretation, as you suggest, it's quite mind-boggling if you really go into it, that there could be another version of you and another version of me operating side by side alongside of us. And it's extraordinary, but it's also, as you're also mentioning, becoming seriously considered by a large number of physicists and scientists and thinkers, that this does seem to be what's going on. And it, to me, it dovetails nicely with the simulation or dreaming hypothesis. Some of these theories kind of go together. And if you think like, well, then how do we navigate between this multiverse? Do we ever explore these other worlds? And through the Mandela effect, you could say, yes, we are exploring them. We are experiencing them. Like I've seen I shrank some silk curtains in my house. I washed them in hot water decades ago. And then a couple years ago, suddenly for no reason, the silk curtains were suddenly exactly as tall as they used to be, as if they'd never shrunk. And the hanger, the rod that I was hanging the curtain on, no longer was at the correct location. But I'd been thinking just a week before that I wish the curtain fit that window better. And then, like within 5 days, boom, the curtains fit the window better. But now I have to rehang them. Very funny. So these kinds of things can happen, and they can. But it's not just in our house. It's not just like it could be anything at any scale, any size. So it could be just the climate of the Earth can be stabilized. You know, the so-called disaster cycle and catastrophe cycle doesn't need to play out the way people say that it always does. You know, everything that we think we know can be changed. And this is good news, I say.
Well, it sounds to me, Cynthia, as if you're saying we've got to come to terms with the fact that the universe is far more bizarre and complex than we have been able to figure out, but we can learn how to surf that reality, that it doesn't have to be intimidating.
Exactly. Right. And that's why I include so many physics terms in the book that I just wrote, because I want people to feel comfortable with it so they can talk about things like you know, this being in a superposition of states, for example, that can, maybe you feel that way if you're daydreaming, like you've got this parallel life where politics worked out the way you like and you're happy and things that happen that are upsetting to you, they happen differently. So you can daydream in that. And sometimes you might find, as I do, that reality can shift and you find yourself in a better, how good can it get kind of a place. And all of that's possible for all of us. Yes.
Well, Cynthia Sue Larson, what a pleasure once again to connect with you. You're a pioneer. You're doing brave work, going into areas where most people would be afraid for their livelihood.
Well, thank you so much. And that's quite a compliment coming from one of my top heroes who's been doing that for so many decades. So thank you for everything that you do.
Well, I have the highest respect for people who are willing to look at topics that other people say, it's just so bizarre, I can't deal with it.
Thank you. Yeah, well, it's my pleasure to be doing this work. And I feel I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't feel it was so important and probably the best thing that all of us can be taking at least a look at, even if we don't devote our whole lives to it the way I do.
You're a person who has found your mission in life, and that is a rare gift and a blessing.
Thank you so much. And right back at you. And I love Thinking Aloud. And I think I mentioned last time, it was my favorite show when I was attending UC Berkeley. It was the best thing on TV, watching you and watching your wonderful guests. And that continues to be true.
Well, thank you so much, Cynthia. Thank you for being with me today and with the New Thinking Aloud audience. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2. 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.